We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the life of Barack Obama. And our guest is David Remnick. He's the author of a recently published biography titled The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. It's published by Knopf, has been out for a little while now, has been getting a lot of attention. And it's his attempt, and it is a very thorough and detailed attempt, to explore Mr. Obama's background, his roots, his formative experiences, look at those points in his life where perhaps if things had gone one way rather than another, he might not be president today. Try to look at those qualities that's made it possible for him to be so successful in politics. Our guest is the editor of The New Yorker magazine, has been since 1998, was a writer for the magazine before that for several years, and before that, he was a reporter for The Washington Post for 10 years, including 4 years he spent in Moscow. He's the author of a number of books. His most recent, before this Obama biography, was a book about Muhammad Ali, the title King of the World. He is also the author of Lenin's Tomb, The Last Days of the Soviet Empire, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1994. As we talk, questions are welcome. We just encourage people to be brief. I expect we might have a lot of people who'd like to talk with us, and that's fine, but you can really help us by creating space for everyone. If you'd like to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And you may email your questions, comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Remnick, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Great.
Good. I thought it'd be good to begin, as you begin the book, by talking a little bit about this speech, a very important speech that Mr. Obama gave in 2007. And this was at an event which was commemorating a very important event that happened during the Civil Rights Movement back in 1965. And this was at a time, that is, the speech was at a time, when Mr. Obama was really not that well known nationally.
That's right. Obama had announced for the presidency in Springfield, of course. We all remember that. And he had used the metaphor, really, of Abraham Lincoln to talk to a national audience, naturally. I mean, something that penetrates with everybody. But when he went to Selma, Alabama, for a commemoration of the 1965 Civil Rights Movement events, really dramatic events there, he decided to speak directly to the African-American community. If you're going to win the Democratic nomination in this country, and especially if you're a black politician, you've got to make a move on that community. And remember this, I mean, we tend to forget this, that the Clintons had a very good relationship with a lot of black politicians and with the African-American community in general. And it was by no means a foregone conclusion that Obama, who was really only lightly known throughout the country. You know, there was one night where he had a big night at the convention in 2004, but that was it. So he had to really start moving on that community and get known and speak to them in a direct way. And so that's where he gives this speech, and he describes himself as the head of the Joshua generation after paying thanks to the Moses generation, which had been at the forefront of the Civil Rights Movement. He had been obviously too young to be a part of.
And this, I think it's important for a couple of reasons, because it says something about his gutsiness. It says something about him as a political tactician. And it also seems to say something about how he views himself. Is it really true, you think, that he views himself as the fulfillment of this long movement?
Well, I think the Civil Rights Movement is only a part of a long, let's call it the Black Liberation Struggle, which begins even during slavery, right? So this is not something that comes to an end with the assassination of Martin King or the dissolution of groups in the 70s. It's something that it goes on because the need goes on. I mean, when you look at the incarceration rates of black men, when you look at, you know, a city like Chicago, which is in so many ways a world capital, and yet by the accounting of the Chicago Tribune is the most segregated de facto city in the country, when you look at all kinds of disparities that persist in this country, that to call an end to the civil rights struggle just because Martin Luther King is no longer on the scene, or even that that there's an African-American president, is a delusion. We don't live in a post-racial world.
Well,
it's not the same as it was in 1965 by any stretch, thank God, and it's not the same as it was before that. But we don't live in Nirvana either.
Yeah. What he seems very clearly to be doing here is claiming the banner of leadership, perhaps not suggesting that he would be the only person to...
Well, he's claiming the banner of leadership, but he's doing it in electoral politics, right? Martin Luther King is certainly the leader of the civil rights movement, but he's doing it, it's an outsider movement. It's an outsider movement that's pressing upon the institutions of power. Obama's doing something very different. He is, in the campaign, he is running for power.
Were there people who, I think that after he was, after he became the candidate, and certainly after he was elected, there were people who recognized his significance. Were there, do you think, a lot of people who, outside of Mr. Obama's immediate circle, who before he was elected, at the point where he was a candidate, and perhaps even before he was the nominee, who recognized that he had the potential to go the distance and actually be elected?
Well, it's a great question. It was a question, I think, even in the inner circle. I think that Obama, when he ran for Senate in Illinois in 2004, which your viewers remember well, you know, he faced a really weak candidate in the end, having secured the nomination through good campaigning but also great fortune, you know, his main competitors losing because of their divorce records coming open. Mm-hmm. He faced Alan Keyes, but even Alan Keyes got under his skin. Even Alan Keyes, who had no chance of winning, managed to irritate Obama. And so even someone like David Axelrod, when he was discussing with Obama the possibility of running for president, said, look, I have to figure out, are you Muhammad Ali or are you Floyd Patterson? Are you somebody who has the strength to go the political distance, or do you have a glass chin? And he kind of provoked Obama in some way.
I think you, in interviews, you certainly have been honest and straightforward and said that while you felt that early on Obama was certainly very impressive, you would have said, well, there's no way this guy is going to be elected president of the United States.
No. I'm totally honest about it. I mean, I had a bet with my colleague in the office for $100, and I thought there's just no way that Obama could beat Hillary Clinton. For all of Hillary Clinton's negatives, she was the Democratic Party establishment. She was herself a historic candidate by being a woman, which is a rather larger constituency than African Americans either. I didn't think her campaign would be capable of blowing it to the degree that they did, and I didn't recognize soon enough just how powerfully compelling Obama would be as a candidate himself.
Do you think that, though, that there are a lot of people who supported him and who voted for him, or who voted for someone, they had some idea of him, some ideal sort of Barack Obama in their head, and that once he became president and once he actually got down to the job of leading and actually started doing things, that there were a lot of people that said, well, wait a minute, this isn't the person I voted for.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely true, but I think it's always true because of the reality that if you are a good campaigner, you campaign to a degree in poetry, and then you have to govern in prose. You have to deal in realities. And Obama's poetry was a very powerful one. It was the poetry of bringing to electoral politics the poetry and the romance and also the pain of a long struggle. And he was able to echo this movement and bring it into electoral politics, and this was very powerful, a very powerful impulse for a lot of voters, including myself. But once you've become the President of the United States, I don't think the Republican Party gives a damn about your poetry. In fact, they hardly give a damn about your prose when it comes to ferocious debates over health care or financial regulatory reform or all those issues that we've now seen the most partisan Washington struggle over.
Mm. Certainly, he's been heavily criticized by people who are on the right conservative side of the political spectrum, and some people have used some very kind of inflated rhetoric talking about how radical he is. Maybe that's not so surprising.
Well, I think it's crazy. I have to say, the notion that somehow Barack Obama is radical in the sense that the weathermen were radical, in the sense that the Black Power movement was radical, or American Socialist Party in the long ago was radical. This is nuts. It's just, let's call it what it is. He is in the left center of the spectrum of American politics and the Democratic Party. Period. And what comes out of this kind of nutty analysis is even nuttier analysis of who he is in his biography. So much so that you have a mayor of a sizable town in Illinois that you know well in Champaign, who questions whether he's even an American. I mean, I'm sorry, but one can only come to the conclusion that this kind of craziness has to do with Obama's otherness to some people, and this relates to race. I mean, it is crazy, the notion that he wasn't born in Honolulu. Not only is there a birth certificate available to all to see, there were also reports in the local press in Honolulu at the time of his birth. I mean, what insane conspiracy could possibly have been concocted to plant such stories 48 years ago with the foreknowledge that he would be president of the United States? I mean, what imagination concocts this? And it's encouraged by leaders of the conservative opposition. And it's deeply unhealthy.
What really strikes me, though, you have that kind of view of Mr. Obama from the right. There are also people who are very, very liberal way over on the other side, the opposite numbers of those people.
Look, I have no problem. This is something entirely different. It is no problem to argue with Barack Obama on the issues, on substance, on, say, in health care, the issue of cost, or on Iran, the question of how to deal with a nuclear Iran. These are serious questions and should be dealt with by serious people in serious ways. If the people on the left are going to argue with him because he's been insufficiently hard-minded about dealing with the Bush administration or civil rights questions or any number of other things, or if people on the right have issues with him that are serious, bring it on. That's what American political debate should be all about. But it's this conspiracy theory and conspiracy mongering that is deeply dangerous and can lead to nothing good.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is David Remnick. He is the editor of The New Yorker magazine, has been since 1998. He is the author of a new biography of Barack Obama. The title is The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. It's published by Knopf. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'd like to have you talk about Obama's parents, starting with his father. He left the family when Barack was a baby, and then for the rest of his life, I think he managed to spend about a week. A little,
10 days, that's it. When Obama was about 10 years old, Obama's father reappeared for a visit in Honolulu for 10 days, and it's portrayed very well in Obama's own autobiography as a deeply confusing moment in his life, as you can imagine. It's really, really a very difficult thing for him to assimilate.
How did the absent father, aside from the fact of the absence, do you think, influence him, shape
him? Well, in many ways. I mean, first of all, he leaves him with a racial legacy. I mean, Obama is to look at him, African-American. He's black. And so that's one legacy. And then there's the legacy of who Obama Sr. was, and in fact, he's a very ambitious man, a political man, a feckless man, an inconstant guy. And I think in some ways that Obama lived his life as an adult in part without getting too gooey and psychoanalytical about it.
Hmm.
In contradistinction to his father, he wanted to have the kind of discipline that his father lacked, the kind of stability that his father lacked, the kind of family loyalty that his father was incapable of.
He certainly is a very ambitious man. There also seems to be a kind of a restless quality about him, as if he's someone who was never really quite satisfied. In fact, I know you have talked a lot about the fact that along the way, when he was in the State House, then he was in the Senate, he very quickly became bored.
Yeah, well, that's true, although probably one can't fault him for that. I think that he got to the State House and he pretty quickly recognized that the degree to which politics was high-minded there was almost zero, and the degree to which it's a lot of horse trading was shocking to him as somebody who was a little bit of a wide-eyed idealist. And I think he also recognized that to be in the minority in Springfield in those days was to have almost no power at all.
Mm. It just, and I'm sure with what this is armchair psychologizing, something I think that you do and try to avoid. But you also wonder, well, what is it that as he's going along through life, what is it that he is looking for and somehow never seems quite to find?
Well, he finds it. I think he really does find it. I mean, he becomes the president of the United States. And one hopes that he's found a certain sense of fulfillment of his ambitions there, because if not there, where? He's a very ambitious guy, and he was from certainly by the – I think the ambition in him really kind of blew up in the best sense at Harvard Law School when he becomes the president of the Harvard Law Review. It's a moment in his life that suggests there's not a great amount of limit to what he's capable of.
Yeah. It just, I suppose, it also makes you wonder, though, about having attained this position at such a young age, you know, what's your second act? Where do you go from there?
I don't understand. What's Obama's
after,
second act?
Yeah, what's Obama's second act? I mean, you know, after having been the president of the United States, he's a really young guy, so now what?
I don't worry about that too much. I think I think the country doesn't have to be Barack Obama's career advisor. I think he'll figure it out. And if he's president for 8 years and he accomplishes enormous amounts, I don't think there's any limits of what he can do. One of the avenues that he may well have taken had he failed in politics, and he was very close to failing in politics. Remember that he lost a congressional race in Bobby Rush's district on the South Side in 2000. And his family, principally Michelle, was not exactly eager for him to run for anything again. He was very taken by the life of a writer, as well as to do good in other ways. He has more of the personality of a writer than any president I can recall. And certainly when he was campaigning, he needed his alone time more than somebody like Bill Clinton, who needs people time as much as humanly possible.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. Let's talk with someone here, somebody in Champaign, and this is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello?
Yeah, hi, David. Great show. Thanks for taking my
sure.
call. What I would offer to your listeners would be, actually, David, your interview with President Obama, I think back about 4, 5, 6 years ago when he was running for Senate, so anybody wants to delve into that, it makes for a very interesting listen, just quick.
In fairness, I didn't interview him when he ran for Senate.
No, yeah. Nor did I.
Oh, we had a two David problem. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, he's on the archives.
Somebody did.
David, but
I think you might mean Bill Finnegan in The New Yorker. That might be it.
Well, okay. In any case.
Yeah.
In any case, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
The guest answered my question here, but there was, when President Obama was elected, there was a good, interesting program on Frontline looking at his political history. And just to echo what you were saying, it came very close. I mean, it's almost like the stars aligned with the opportunity for Obama to become president. One thing happened after another, and he kind of went with it. And my question is, does your guest think that he would end up being president if all these things didn't happen just as, you know, they happened in line there where he became a state senator and then a U.S. senator, so on and so forth?
It's a great question. You know, it's what we call in the business counterfactual history. You know, if Hitler had tripped on a banana peel, would there have been the Second World War and that kind of thing? And the real answer is, who the hell knows? The secondary answer is, you're probably right. I mean, look, Obama has a lot of talents and undeniable intelligence and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he also, at certain points in his career, had a tremendous amount of luck. And he was never so lucky as in 2004, which is a real breakthrough, as all people in Illinois know. Remember, he had lost a congressional race in 2000, and he had lost it badly. He decides to run for Senate. Blair Hull was the leading Democratic candidate, and he had more money than you could possibly imagine, and he was spending it. And the only reason he fell apart was that his divorce records came out, and it turned out that he had hit his wife and all kinds of other nasty stuff.
Sure.
Then, Obama is called upon by the Democratic Party to give a big speech at the convention, at which point he becomes a national political figure. This is an enormously great stroke of luck. And then, in the same year, a very tough Republican candidate named Jack Ryan, who could have been real trouble, even in Illinois, where the Democrats have an advantage, certainly upstate, in the northern part of the state, he falls apart because his divorce records are a mess. So one, two, three, it leads the way to the Senate, and the second that Obama is in the Senate, the very second that he wins, the press conference after his victory is all about, will you run for president? So it is a rather blessed political career.
Yes, it was a very fast track. I still remember Jack Ryan's TV commercials where he walks from the boardroom into a outside school to teach, and of course, his past came out, and it was a little bit different than that. But my last question, I'll ring off. Do you think Obama had served some time as an activist on the south side of Chicago, and then he went to Harvard? Do you think that was in his plan all along, or did you think he needed the Harvard education to kind of give him credentials?
It's another great question. I really think that he, as an organizer on the South Side, after a couple of years, realized the limits of being an organizer. I think he realized how frustrating the work was, how hard it was to make an impact, and how necessary it was to get in the big-time political game in order to make a big-time impact. And to have the tools to do that, I think he thought he needed the credential and the extra education of going to law school. And for him, you know, and certainly Harvard is, if not the top law school, it's certainly among the, you know, up there with Yale and Columbia, NYU, and so on. He felt he needed that time of study before returning to Chicago. And there was never any question that he'd return to Chicago. Chicago became home to him. It became a place where his heart was and his community was. And there was no question that he was going to return to Chicago.
And is there something about Chicago, either its scale, its politics, that really made it possible for him to become involved in politics?
Well, you're talking to a New Yorker whose second favorite city is Chicago, and I don't say that to pander. I really always look forward to going there, and I think Chicago, in some ways, and this has been told to me by many Chicagoans, allows for a certain permeability that New York may not. Although it was not easy for Obama to get his political start. I mean, he got a lot of resistance as somebody who wasn't born and bred there, who's somebody who, you know, was a relative newcomer. And he got kicked around a lot, both in the state Senate, early state Senate race in 95-96, and then when he tried to make a bid on Bobby Rush's seat in 2000. That said, Chicago gave him everything. It gave him a church. It gave him a family. It gave him a community. It gave him a sense of purpose. I think Chicago just and particularly the South Side, although certainly Obama's world expanded within Chicago, but particularly the South Side was something that he needed in many ways.
Yeah, and this is his going to Chicago initially to be the organizer was one of these happy accidents.
You're absolutely right. It was a total stroke of luck. He read a want ad in a little tiny newspaper called Community Jobs.
This was when he was in New York, right?
Placed there by this great guy on the South Side of Chicago, still there, named Jerry Kelman, who was a community organizer, a white community organizer, who was working in a predominantly black area and knew that he needed a black organizer, not for cynical reasons, but for realistic reasons. And the first time he got a phone call from Obama, he didn't know whether he was black, white, or Japanese. It was only until they met in New York at a coffee shop on Lexington Avenue where they really kind of had a mind meld, and Obama, you know, packed his suitcase and threw it in the back of a crappy old car that he had and came out to Chicago.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is David Remnick. He is editor of The New Yorker magazine and is the author of a new biography of Barack Obama. The title of the book is The Bridge, Life and Rise of Barack Obama. It's published by Knopf. Another caller here in Urbana, line one.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hey, good morning. Let's spend a little time on the question of temperament. And the reason I bring that up is, you know, I think of Bush, you know, barely elected, thought he had the greatest mandate in the world, pushing legislation through like there was no tomorrow. And here you get Obama, the greatest electoral Senate congressional mandate since Reagan. And, you know, he spends a year wasting time with Republicans. So I just have to think somewhere in his background, maybe there's some kind of search for, you know, being conciliatory with other folks or just trying to reach out, build bridges rather than try to, you know, focus on something very specific and using the tools, votes, Congress, Senate, you've got the numbers behind you and just kind of ram stuff through. So let's get into that a little bit.
Sure. I think, look, this is a big question and an important one. I'm glad you raised it. There's no question that Obama's habit of mind early on was a conciliatory one. I think he won the presidency of the Harvard Law Review, not least because he was appealing not only to the liberals, but also because he was appealing to conservatives who felt listened to, who felt that okay, you may not agree with me, but at least you're listening to me, as opposed to maybe some of the other people on the center left or left at the Law Review. So Obama came to believe in that and saw it as a great part of his own political, I don't know, personality, you could say. Then he comes up against the reality of Congress. And we've never had a more polarized Congress. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, I'm 51, so I remember in the Senate when there was a creature almost like a dinosaur, known as a liberal Republican, like Jacob Javits. I remember moderate Republicans. Nowadays, moderate Republicans are going to become endangered species. Look at the governor of Florida, who's about to get the back of his head kicked in, it seems. It's a very, very different political atmosphere. And Obama began the year, he began his term, you're absolutely right, by trying to make a place for at least some Republicans in this health care package, and it just came to failure. It came to sadness. And in fact, his skills of conciliation had to be practiced upon the Blue Dog Democrats, the conservative Democrats.
So here's the thing. Let's say that he's got a little bit more dry powder. I mean, maybe he's learned a valuable lesson here. Maybe he hasn't. Mm-hmm. He might be captive to his own psychology here and his own strategies. But, you know, from my perspective, when you've got the numbers behind you the way you do, you know, you've got, you know, you should have the, I don't know, you've got the resources behind you. You've got the oomph to kind of try to pass stuff through. I mean, there's no reason.
Well, he passed. I mean, in fairness, in the end, he did what no president since Truman did, which is pass a gigantic, however limited, healthcare package. I mean, it brings 30-plus million Americans onto the rolls of healthcare. I mean, that is a big accomplishment, and a big accomplishment achieved in a certain political environment that's very, very, very difficult. So credit where credit is due. You know, one of the things that I think is going to be overlooked, has been overlooked about the first year of the presidency, is the appointment of Sonia Sotomayor. One of the great swing votes in this country, potentially, is the Hispanic vote. Not all Hispanics vote with their left hand. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what effect that does or does not have in either midterm elections or in the presidential election down the line. Yeah.
I want to thank the caller, invite others. We're a little bit past our midpoint here, talking with David Remnick about his new biography of Barack Obama, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little earlier about Obama's father. And what were the sort of influences that come from the other side here, from his mother?
Well, his mother is really interesting, and I felt that one of my goals in doing this book was to portray her in a fuller way. Weirdly, in his own memoir, Obama portrays his father, who's an absence, in a fuller way than he does his mother, who's a presence. And he does this for a certain reason. I mean, he's in search of this identity aspect of his life, and he's pursuing the truth of his father's story in a very dramatic way. I understand why he does this. But the mother is extremely intelligent, a genuine academic, but also a genuine kind of idealist, social activist type, who is pursuing a PhD in Indonesia, juggling, you know, having two children, has two divorces. It's not easy. She's an activist on issues like the empowerment of third world women and many other things like it. And I find her an extremely fascinating combination of intelligence, idealism, and almost at times heedless independence. I mean, remember, she lives totally apart from Obama throughout his entire high school years.
Hmm. And that seems, again, to be something that you would think would be very important. She was much more in his life than his father, but there also were these long absences.
Yes, this is true. This is true. And, you know, it can't be easy for a kid to it can't be easy for a kid to be without his mother for 4 years in that period of time and live with your grandparents. It's complicated. Yeah.
And that was what he was living with his grandparents in Hawaii. And this is really interesting because, and something that certainly that you point out, that while we think of Hawaii as being a multicultural kind of place, there were not a lot of black people in Hawaii. So at this point, this was when he was thinking about trying to figure out what exactly it meant to be black.
Yeah, most of us, when we're trying to figure ourselves out as adolescents, as young people, the ethnic part of it is pretty much given to us, right? I mean, we figure it out at the breakfast table or at church or synagogue or mosque or in the community or in school. I mean, it's there. It's provided. Provided by genetics, provided by family history. Not for Obama. Obama is in a white household, and he looks into a mirror, and he's black. He goes to school that talks all about multiculturalism, and there really aren't very many black kids at all, maybe two or three. The African-Americans in Hawaii are mainly on military bases, even though it's an incredibly multicultural environment. It's mostly Asians and whites and all the rest. So Obama has to seek this out in a way that most of us don't. He has a choice in how he's going to do this in a way that most of us have maybe a more limited choice. So that's the complication in his life.
He had the opportunity certainly in Hawaii, and then when he came to college in the United States, to go to some very, very good schools. Punahou is apparently just an incredible place to be, the high school that he went to in Hawaii. And while obviously he was a bright kid, he was not a superstar.
No, he wasn't. He was a B student in high school, mind you, at a very good high school. It wasn't an easy high school. And at good colleges, he was a good but not unbelievable student. It's really when he gets to law school that he kind of explodes with his – begins to fulfill the obvious potential that's there.
And was there something, was it about the atmosphere? Was it about the people he was with? Was it about the mentors he had the opportunity to have? Was it just something about this?
I think we grow up.
Yeah?
I think we grow up in life if we're lucky, right? We wake up. We stop. It's not unknown for kids to mess around when they're in high school. You put the beer aside. You put the bong aside. You pick up the book. You get serious. You sort of get with the program a little bit. You understand that you're not a kid anymore. That idealism is fine, but you've got to do something about it. You begin to look at the potential in yourself and realize that you've got to do something about it. And that's what he did.
Talk about the importance of Michel in his life.
Well, I don't want to pretend that I'm inside this family to a degree where I can give you an insight that's like a best friend. I mean, I don't want to be a fraud. But clearly, not only is this a very close marriage, but also it provided things that were missing in Obama's own life, a kind of whole, traditional, stable, all-in-one-place family, not with an absent father, not with a mother flying all over the world, but rather with everybody under one roof, eating dinner together. This appealed to him enormously. He had had enough of instability. He had had enough of being untethered.
It certainly does seem to be, from what you can see of her, certainly of her public persona, and maybe all of the clues that we get. You know, people talk about their partners being their anchor. Well, it certainly seems that in his case, that's one of the things that she does for him, that she is
no
for
question.
Him.
No question. I think that's absolutely true. And it's clearly a source of great solace and stability and love and for him. And, and she's not always easy on him, as no good spouse is totally easy on his or her partner. And there were times when Michelle Obama was fed up with politics. She didn't have a lot of faith in the ability of standard politics to do good in this world. Remember, she's from Chicago. She earned her skepticism in a town where politics is a very, very mixed bag, I don't need to tell you. And after he lost in a race that she had hoped that he wouldn't undertake in the first place, she was very dubious about him getting back in, to say the least.
How did she feel about this decision to run for president of the United States?
She had to be convinced. I think she had to be convinced that it was a good idea, that it wasn't a futile gesture. By the time he had won the Senate, she was all in terms of politics. It's not like she was objecting every step of the way. But, there were safety issues. There were issues of, was this a quixotic run? Why was he running for president after getting into the Senate 5 minutes before? She had to be brought along. She had to have. She had to be convinced in a very methodical way. By the way, so did Obama himself. So this was not a process that took one evening at the dinner table.
Yeah, I guess I found myself thinking about maybe one of the last individuals who a lot of people felt had the potential to do what Mr. Obama did, and that was Colin Powell. And my sort of feeling that one of the most important people in his life, closest to him, his wife, the reason that he didn't do it was because she didn't want him to.
I think that's absolutely true. It's a real marriage, and you can even see this from the outside. I don't want to pretend to be on the inside. But in the end, I have to say that Barack Obama has, in whatever way possible, has won those battles. There were all along the way, Michelle objected to this race or that, but once he won the battle of yes or no, she was all in. She campaigned hard.
Let's talk with another caller on Champagne here, line one. Hello.
Yes, I want to ask a question. You know, for my satisfaction, I'm African-American, and I cringe, in fact, bleed a little bit when I hear the vicious personal attacks on the president and, in some degree, from the conservative Republicans on the First Lady. Let me ask you, in light of his personality and his temperament and Michelle's temperament, are they, in fact, affected adversely by some of the vicious personal attacks from the birthers, the Marxists, the conspiracy theorists, or am I wasting my time worrying about their well-being for nothing in terms of their emotional well-being?
Well, I'm not privy to the pillow talk of Barack and Michelle Obama, and you wouldn't expect me to be, but I do have to say that considering the amount of this kind of nonsense and the viciousness that can come from places on the internet or Fox News or other sources, obvious sources of some of this, or out of the mouths of Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann and others, it's amazing the equanimity, the calmness with which it's received in the White House. I think it's amazing. And I don't think the rest of us would probably react in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes a lot of practice and the development of a very, very thick skin. But I can't possibly believe it has no effect at all.
Right, right.
I think, you know, they're human beings.
Right.
They're not, you know, immune to stealing a peek at cable news, or they're perfectly aware of what's going on and what's said, and it's just said over and over again.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. I'll stop worrying about it so much.
Well, you know, I wouldn't stop worrying about it, though. I think the problem is that a lot of it's just junk, but it has a corrosive effect on some people, and one begins to fear what effect it has on the truly outlandishly crazy people.
That's what I worry about.
You know, we live in a country that's got a history.
Right.
And I don't need to outline what that history is.
I know what it is, right.
You know, I remember in the Israeli prime minister's race in the mid-90s.
Right.
When Yitzhak Rabin was running against Netanyahu, and when the rhetoric got out of hand there, that it inflamed enough people on the very fringes of politics that a maniac did what a maniac did.
Right.
And I think I'm a First Amendment absolutist. How could I be otherwise as an editor of this magazine?
Mm-hmm.
People should be able to say what they want to say, but they ought to think twice before propagating lies and things that really begin to have a corrosive effect on all of us.
I agree wholeheartedly, and thank you for your time.
All right, sure. Thanks for the call. We have about 5-6 minutes left with David Remnick. He is the editor of The New Yorker magazine. He's the author of a new biography of Barack Obama. The title is The Bridge, published by Knopf. It's certainly Barack Obama knows that he is black, and knows what it is to be black, and he certainly in his life, I'm sure, has experienced racism. But it doesn't really seem, at least not as a personal experience, to be something that he talked very much about. And was that because, and I know also, though, one of the things you write about is, in fact, during the campaign, his advisors didn't really want him to. So how do you sort out his natural inclination to talk about race, his personal experiences, and then also add into that the realities of campaigning and what maybe you want to talk about and what you don't?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. I'd say this about Barack Obama. I think that he's more transparent than all these discussions let on. I think he is who he is. I think he is who he says he is. And the debate should be focused on politics. The debate should be focused on policy. The debate should be focused on the question of what's right and what's wrong to do going forward in policy areas. That, to me, seems to be the most important focus. And to get too caught up in the other stuff is unfortunate.
One thing I want to make sure we talk about a little bit here is the the Jeremiah Wright chapter of the campaign. Mm-hmm. And another one of those places where truly there seemed to be a crisis and Mr. Obama really rose to the occasion and used a speech, I think, as a way of turning things around. But this was at a point it was very problematic because of some of the comments that the Reverend Wright, who was the pastor of a church that the Obamas had attended in Chicago, some of the things that he said, which makes you wonder, first of all, about him and about whether he was using the opportunity of the spotlight to pursue some sort of personal agenda or whether to what extent this was maybe influenced by his feeling that he hadn't been treated right by Mr. Obama.
Well, I think this was a very painful episode for Barack Obama and an equally painful one for Jeremiah Wright. Jeremiah Wright had done a lot of good in his church. He had done a lot of good for the people that he had worked with and been the pastor to for many, many years. He had built up a very big church there. I think he had expected a very different year for himself, somebody who was retiring, having accomplished an enormous amount, and somebody who was going to see one of his flock possibly become president of the United States. And history was turned on its head, and it was very painful for Jeremiah Wright, who I think felt deeply wounded by all this, no matter what he said from the pulpit. I think it was equally painful for Obama, even though he was he had deep, deep, deep disagreements with some of those things that that Jeremiah Wright had said. He clearly had been very close to him. So, but the speech was both a sincere speech about race, but also a political rescue for himself. He had to do this. He would have lost had he not rescued the situation.
And that to this day that relationship has been broken, and there's been no contact between the two of them since.
No, they had one meeting, a quiet meeting on their own, but it didn't go very well long ago. And so far as I know, there's been no contact between them.
I guess I can certainly understand that if not Mr. Obama, then people in the campaign would have been very angry about the Reverend Wright and would have said something like, you know, here we got a guy, Mr. Obama, who's got a shot at being the first black president. And what's this man doing?
Yeah, I think they were very confused by it. And I think Reverend Wright thought, look, in my realm, I'm right. And he just refused to step down. In a sense, he refused to be quiet. And a lot of people were angry at him for that. In his own terms, he felt he was right. And it was a kind of clash of worlds, the larger political world and the world that Reverend Wright inhabits. And that was some of the source for their painful clash.
And did the people in the Obama circle at least understand or believe that the things that Reverend Wright was saying, that he, Reverend Wright, actually did believe all that?
Well, I don't think Reverend Wright is ever rescinded anything that he said from the pulpit or otherwise. Reverend Wright simply has in many ways different politics than Barack Obama. This is not unusual for somebody who's a congregant to have different disagreements with their pastor, no matter how close they are, their rabbi or their imam.
We have a couple of minutes here, at least one more caller, and that's someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This Reverend Wright business keeps coming up. But if you examine what he said, there was nothing extremely outrageous. He simply dared to tell the truth, and it was uncomfortable for the United States and for the American people to hear the truth. But this is the truth as he saw it. And it was not helpful to Mr. Obama as a candidate, but there was nothing very untrue about what he said.
Well, you can debate that. I'm not here to argue that through. Clearly, Barack Obama would not agree with some of the rhetoric that Jeremiah Wright was quoted as saying. I think that's plain and evident. And that would be the case both before and after the commencement of a presidential campaign.
The story that you're telling here, it essentially ends with his inauguration, and you don't go into the, his actual presidency. Are there, though, have now having watched him in office for a little while, anything that you have seen that you think is particularly surprising or revealing?
Well, no. I think if you went into this with the understanding of the reality that Barack Obama is a center-left politician from the Democratic Party, he hasn't surprised me because his campaign promises and rhetoric pretty much reflect what he's done as a president. You can be disappointed with them. I think if you're on the left, you're disappointed about certain things, and if, even if you voted for him, and even in the center-right, if you voted for him, you're certainly disappointed about certain things. But I think he's been fairly true. There's been nothing terribly shocking. From the moment he appointed people like Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, you realize that, you know, this is not somebody that's from the far left of the Democratic Party. Otherwise, there would have been appointments elsewhere.
Just as a way of finishing up, I guess, and we talked about this a little bit before, one of the things that overall just really strikes me, I think, is that how it is that so many different people can look at Barack Obama and see the Barack Obama that they want to, that so many different people can see him so differently, that people, as we talked before, that people can see, on one side can people see him as this dangerous radical, on the other side people say, well, this guy's not really different, for, you know, he's a political establishment guy. How you can project onto him an awful lot of your own stuff.
Well, I think that happened in the campaign. I think some of it's was the result of an exhaustion with the Bush administration and the level of hope that was engendered by his campaign, also by Obama's capacity as an electoral candidate to somehow quote or summon some of the emotion of non-electoral movements like the civil rights movement. So there are sources for why he's more of a Rorschach test than some politicians normally are. But once you move from the poetry of campaigning to the prose of governing, I think some of that begins, those mists start to evaporate.
Our guest is David Remnick. He's the editor of The New Yorker magazine. His new book is The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, published by Knopf. Mr. Remnick, thank you very much for talking with us.
Totally my pleasure. Thanks.